Welcome to the podcast, where we challenge conventional thinking and explore fresh, forward-looking perspectives on leadership. Whether you're a seasoned executive or an aspiring leader, join us on a journey to uncover the complexities of modern leadership. Because leadership itself may not change, but the way we think about it is constantly evolving. This is Rethinking Leadership, a podcast by T. Yas Business School, hosted by Executive Professor Rumer Visser.
Guest in today's episode, I'm excited to say, is Dr. Richard Boyatzis. Richard is Distinguished University Professor at Case Western Reserve University, a professor in the departments of Organizational Behavior, Psychology, and Cognitive Science. He is the fellow in the American Psychological Association, Society for Industrial Organizational Psychology, and the Association for Psychological Sciences. He runs a MOOC, a massive open online course with more than 1.5 million students or participants. He's been cited as among the top 1% of all scientists worldwide. He's the author of more than 200 articles and 9 books on topics such as leadership, motivation, behavior change, emotional intelligence, and managerial competencies. And his latest book, published in 2024, is called The Science of Change, Discovering Sustained Desired Change from Individuals to Organizations and Communities. Richard, welcome to this episode.
Thank you, Rumer.
So I'm kind of curious of kind of the backstory of how you came to this line of work.
So my parents immigrated from Greece. By the time my father got here just to the U.S. just in time to be drafted and to serve 2 years in the U.S. Army in the Panama jungles and then land on Normandy Beach and do all that. So by the time he got out, even though he'd started a university in Greece, by the time he got out, got married. He became a waiter and worked in restaurants his whole life. The net result was my parents didn't have much money, actually none, to give me to help me through school. So, you know, it was always a question as to what was going to happen. And when Sputnik went up, there was a furor in the U.S. They tested everyone in every grade level. And it turned out that I tested really strong in math and physics.
Ah.
Jump ahead, the school system out on Long Island put me into an experimental program. So I had 2 years of college before I finished high school. I got into MIT, my number one choice in the aeronautics and astronautics program. So I am, by training and by practice, a space scientist, engineer, a rocket scientist, if you will, in the vernacular. I was in one of two research departments. We were all Sheldons, if you watch Big Bang Theory. I mean, we were all anywhere from super smart to scary smart. All except one guy were socially incompetent, including the department managers. So it became very clear that, you know, management has got to be easy. So I go to sign up for a management course because I had only two technical courses left to finish my degree. So I figured, why not get ready for what I want to do? And this one young fellow who was finishing his PhD at Harvard in psychology, Dave Kolb, who you may know from experiential learning theory, learning styles, and tutorial. He described his course, and it sounded like utter crap to me. It was organizational psychology.
Did you ever tell him that?
But in his description, he said two words that made me race to the basement room, and I did get into his course. And those two words were no tests. So the entire path of my future, to some extent, was evolved because I later learned in my psychology doctorate at Harvard that I'm test phobic. I've always been test phobic. I've always done poorly on tests because of good old classic anxiety and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, I seemed to have a facility with it. I wanted to study how managers didn't help their subordinates. And he said, well, I've got some real data on our MBAs helping or not helping each other. I worked on it. He offered me a summer job. We ended up publishing the paper. But Dave Kolb and Ed Schein and a couple others, by December that year had convinced me that I should go to graduate school, which I never thought. They had to explain to me what came next because I was the first to go to college on this side of the Atlantic, and nobody ever explained to me, but they did. And then they explained to me that in psychology, you actually go for a PhD and you get a master's along the way, but you don't start by going for a master's. And that they thought I should go in psychology because that's where my forte was, not management. I applied in my arrogance to two doctoral programs. I got into both. I decided to go to Harvard. And I was enthralled by that point with the whole idea of how do people change. Dave Kolb and I eventually published two of the four papers we wrote off of this data set. I was enthralled with the concept of psychotherapy, and I did my training. So I was a therapist for a number of years working with alcoholics and drug addicts in the 70s. But I was really intrigued with what are the constituent things that help people change or not, and not at just individual level. I mean, I remember in 1970, I wrote one of my doctoral qualifying papers on a systems dynamics model of organizational change. In the spring of 1967, that's when Dave Kolb and I were drafting the early version of what eventually now, almost 60 years later, is my intentional change theory. So I've been fascinated by this thing about now, and over the decades, it became very clear that what I was after wasn't just change, it was desired change. So I was going to forget all the stuff that happens that you don't wish didn't, because somebody else can study that. But what really is very clear, and you don't have to work with alcoholics and drug addicts very long not to appreciate this, is that I was after sustained desired change. What lasted 1, 2, 3 years? And since the data showed that almost none of all of the leadership training in industry and government to this day, something like 89% of it shows no value.
You know, that's my line of work, right? You know, that's my line of work, right, Richard?
Yeah. Well, you know, God bless you. I'm not saying, you know, the field hasn't spawned millions of consultants, but as to whether or not you're actually helping organization change, I mean, I got to tell you, the action, when you actually put it to a research test, the results are abysmal. Now, not just to make you feel crappy, but in graduate management education is worse. There, the evidence says that there may be a 2% impact on the competencies, the behaviors that are predictive of effective leadership and management and professions. And they seem to extinguish within a year and a half.
Yeah. Well, that does make me feel better because, as you may know, I also run an executive MBA program. So that's the other part.
Right. Well, it's actually, you're likely in the executive MBA to do better because you tend to have older people that have more context. And usually executive MBA programs are much more project and study group focused. Yep. And it turns out when you study what really helps people retain learning in any form of graduate education, physicians, lawyers, doesn't matter. But even in management, it's doing a lot of projects, field projects, not abstract cases or Harvard Business School cases. Those are manicured. Yep. Real projects and working in teams. Yep. And most people graduate with more value added from an EMBA than an MBA.
Yeah.
In part because they're challenging. I mean, I love them. I've been teaching EMBA since 1989. I love it because they're always challenging. And about 60% of mine tend to be surgeons, which makes them even more arrogant, which is fine with me. I mean, I am too. So what the hell? But the idea is we have discovered enough research to say, what is it that helps people learn and hang on to it?
Yeah.
And that's where in all of the efforts at change, despite the abysmal results compared to the amount of money and energy put into it, people do change, and organizations change, and communities change, and countries change. And it, as it turns out, when it works so well that it makes up for all the rest of the, wasted effort. I mean, we showed in OD projects in the U.S. Army, spent 2 years under contract, my former research company.
Looking at organization development?
I'm sorry. Well, actually, they called it organizational effectiveness, but it was organization development.
Yep.
They had teams all over the world. We studied all these projects all over the world and found out that 80% of them did never reach their objectives or added value. But the 20% that did, when you did a full cost analysis of the costs and benefits, paid back the entire cost of the worldwide system 5 times over. So when it hits, it hits really big.
It's like a lottery almost.
Well, in intentional change theory, I have one of the principles is that change tends to be distributed on a power curve, not a Gaussian distribution. Yeah. So normal distribution is not even relevant on human behavior, nevertheless change. Mm. So what happens is you're always after that small tail, because that small tail, accounts for almost everything else. And by the way, this is true of all faculty in universities in terms of papers written or citations. It's true of MBA stars and points. It's true of people in parliament in terms of bills enacted. I mean, no matter how you look at it, it's a very small percentage of the people that really add most of the value. And that power curve distribution, which often is discontinuous, makes us not only cautious, but not very aware of what are the things that contribute to change. Because very often, well, as a consultant, you know this. As a consultant, because I built and ran 2 consulting companies before I became a professor. You're not in the system long enough to see when everything atrophies. And then as soon as the organization is acquired by another organization, the new people want to do away with all of the quote unquote vendors from the old people. So basically, most consulting and training ends up being looking for temporary effects or guilt alleviation on some management. But when you get somebody who really wants to do it well, and again, another feature of intentional change theory is that my theory is the only fractal theory of change at all levels that exists. I've studied every organizational, community development, all these theories.
Yeah, can you explain what you mean by a fractal?
As I explain and describe the causal factors that result in sustained desire change at the individual level, it is identical, not isomorphic. It's not similar. It's identical in dyads and teams and organizations and communities and in countries. So if you want to understand,
it's scalable.
It's scalable. Right? That's right. That's exactly the technical word in complexity. It has scale dependence. And that, but scalable is in terms of the factors. What you have to be careful of is when I was running the consulting company, when the head of, the VP of marketing would say, this is a great leadership program. Let's go company wide. I'd love it because I'd just hear the cash register ringing, ching, ching. That's another million or two in revenue. It became clear by the time I left consulting that that was the kiss of death, because as soon as you imposed the program on people who didn't really want to be there, you became a part of what my theory calls the ought self, which activates the negative emotional attractor, which literally closes people down to change. So what we have found, if I'll go on to your next question, about all of this research on change is that there are some sacred cows out there about leadership, management, and change that are just wrong when you actually put it to, which we have, fMRI tests, neurological studies and hormonal studies and all the rest of it. So, for example, goal setting. Specific goal setting shuts the person down to new ideas neurologically. Why? Because it focuses them. The very thing that goal setting is supposed to do, which is focus you
is great. But think about this. As soon as you're focused, you don't notice what's happening out there. Your competition just changed things. Technology changed. Your clients want something different. You're not seeing it. So and here I am. I published a study saying goal setting was really important to change in 1970.
Yeah.
By 2000, I'm saying, hold it a minute. That's not really true. Yeah. So it turns out that vision is the driver of change, of sustainable change. Purpose.
Yeah.
The big picture, not the micro. Now, I'm not saying goals aren't useful, but they're useful way down the process. And every time people establish them as a way to motivate people, it's as idiotic as doing a strategic plan.
Thank
strategic
you.
Plans do not motivate change, period.
I wish I could put a frame around that one right there. I heard a kind of a tongue-in-cheek commentary on KPIs. You know, what does KPI stand for? It stands for keep people ineffective.
Yeah, right.
It goes right along with what you're saying.
Here's one that those of us in the arena feel. And if you've ever led an organization, or as in your case, you know, you're program director, at least of the MBA program and consulting company and things like that, you know that change, sustained desired change, happens through swarming, emotional swarming, not rational strategic plans. Now, do you need a strategic plan? Yes, because it helps you borrow money from the bank. It helps you make resource allocation decisions. But does it motivate change? No. And I think that the abysmal engagement numbers, which are motivation numbers worldwide, you know, throughout Europe, North America, Japan, everywhere it's tested, is because people are promulgating practices, leadership and management practices, that we thought were the panacea, but it turns out inhibit adaptation.
Yeah. And so you mentioned a second ago, goal setting can really work against you there. What are some of the other sacred cows that are out there today that we're still clinging on to that we now know are just simply
you know, here's one that sounds almost idiotic to say it out loud. Leadership is not about a leader. It's about the relationships that they have with the people around them.
Thank
because
you.
Leadership, by definition, you can't be a leader without followers. And just because somebody reports to you doesn't mean they're not spitting in your coffee when they bring it to you.
Correct.
So what does that mean? That means that what we should be doing when we think and talk about leadership is focus on the relationships.
Yeah.
And yet how many people think the focus should be on the budgets, the numbers, the the goals, the strategic plan? It's the relationships.
Authority. Yeah.
And in fact, I said in one of the chapters in my new book, I said, relationships are the agar-agar in the petri dish of life. It's the context for everything. And now that we know neurologically, we literally infect other people around us in 8 to 40 thousandths of a second. And this is deeply unconscious. Yeah. And we're activating these neural networks in other people, in my theory, with either a pull toward a positive emotional attractor or a negative emotional attractor. Now, you need
both.
Can
you explain those terms? Can you? Because of some complexity theory?
Actually, let me do it in terms of a brief exercise for your listeners.
Yeah. Please.
Think about who helped you the most in your life get to where you are, your whole life, not just work. So I'll pause for a moment, let listeners write down some names. Who helped you become who you are, get to where you are in your life? This is much too fast, but I'll keep it moving.
Yeah.
Go back to the first person you listed and try to remember a moment in which you learned something important. Just put yourself back like you're watching a YouTube video of that moment. And maybe if it helps, write a couple words or phrases next to their name. And I'm going to pause again for a little bit longer. Just let people do that with one or two people.
Okay.
I've done this exercise on all seven continents in about somewhere between 68 and 73 countries. So it doesn't matter whether you're in Astana, Kazakhstan, Milano, Amsterdam, or Boston. Humans react the same way. Mm. And we've had, since 2000, we've had number of studies where we'll have doctoral students go in and do 2-hour interviews to people asking this question: who helped you the most, remember a moment, and then who tried to help you in the last 2 years. What becomes very clear is that I would predict that if people looked at them, at how they feel when they remember these people and the relationships and these moments, is everywhere in the world, people will talk about they feel grateful, they feel thankful, they feel loved, they feel appreciated, honored, proud, heard, respected. Mm. Mm. And they also often report feeling lifted and excited, empowered. Sometimes people report feeling warm and serene. What's amazing is that those feelings are indicators of the parasympathetic nervous system, which is a part of our hormonal system that is the only antidote to stress. It's, I mean, people say you're going to help stress by lowering your stress level is kind of foolish. It means you're impaired, but just mildly impaired. So technically, that's what I'm calling the positive emotional attractor. And yeah, that when we analyze these stories that people come up with, as I would expect your listeners if they did the exercise, what people realize is that in almost every instance, what motivated them was a possibility. Mm. Not, well, you're a woman, you're a girl, you should be a nurse. Not somebody telling you something. Not somebody giving you feedback. I'll come back to that. That's another one of the mm-hmm. sacred cows. Mm-hmm. But actually somebody opening up a possibility, yeah, with almost like, have you considered thinking?
Yeah. And maybe I can sort of highlight something real there, because I think it's really important to really make this point where you say that, you know, the key or the fundamental driver for change is this this sense of possibility. It comes from, I guess, a deep desire, so to speak, right? It's moving towards something that is wanted. And go ahead.
Hope. The key emotion is hope. It turns out in the research.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. And it sounds poetic, but I'm so glad that you have evidence, right, you know, grounded in research that says, no, it is hope. Because right, when, you know, the conventional wisdom, and maybe this is also one of the sacred cows, the conventional wisdom that as I see in anything about change as well, you define your current state, you define your desired state, which, you know, becomes shorthand for the absence of problems. We have a problem here. Our desired state is we don't want to be in trouble anymore.
Roma, if the real ideal discrepancy was motivating sustained change, nobody would be fat or obese. We wouldn't be running out of Ozempic in every country of the world. We wouldn't have an obesity problem in literally every country of the world. Even countries like Japan and China and France are having obesity problems. Because everybody knows, you know, there's an ideal weight. And then if you're over that, you're going to have a lot of problems, not just knee problems and, you know, gasping for air, but you're going to die sooner for all sorts of things. Yeah. So the discrepancy hypothesis that it motivates change is true for a small number of people. Those people who are good at sales, who have what Dave McClellan used to call a high unconscious drive for the need for achievement.
Achievement, yeah.
For them, it does, but they don't actually care about the content. They love the game.
Yes.
That's the measurement stuff. But for almost, you know, most of the population, the motivator of change is not a discrepancy, because once you look at the discrepancy, it's depressing. Why are treatment adherence, which is to what extent do you do what your physicians and nurses tell you to do to get better from disease or after surgery? It runs 50% worldwide in every country tested
on every, whether it's coronary bypass surgery or orthopedic surgery or diabetes. Excuse me. And the reason is, when you have this, most of the time, physicians and nurses try to scare the crap out of you. Oh, well, if you don't lose weight and, you know, eat the right foods and exercise more, you know, at some point you're going to have neuropathy and we'll have to amputate your feet. Well, that might scare people and it motivates them for a week.
Yes, yes, because it's fear-based.
Yeah.
It's also worth highlighting this one. Another sort of conventional wisdom that I think I pick up on, and that is, well, if you want to effectuate change, you got to make it in people's own interest. You got to give them the right incentives and rewards. But this treatment adherence data is direct evidence that that just does not work.
So in my theory, I think the tipping point, the thing that enables you to move from one phase of a change process to the next, an effective change process, I call the positive or negative emotional attractor, using complexity terms. It pulls you around them, not into them, but around them.
Yep.
The positive emotional attractor is being in the parasympathetic, or what I've termed in a whole lot of my research, the renewal state, where you're literally growing new neurons, your immune system is working, you're cognitively at your best. Versus the negative emotional attractor, where you're defensive, you're activating the task positive network neurologically, and the sympathetic nervous system stress. And it's the difference between thinking about possibilities versus problems, hope versus fears, strengths versus weaknesses, you know, optimism versus pessimism. It goes back and forth. But these two pulls are so profound inside of us and so fast that we don't even know that it's happening. Well, my theory says the same thing is happening in couples, dyads, in teams, in organizations, in communities, and in countries. I mean, look what's happening in every one of our countries these days at the political level, because we've artificially created the notion that there are polar opposites, all of which is defensive. There isn't any positive in that. So what we were able to show was that you need the negative emotional attractor. If you didn't have it, you wouldn't be able to wake up in the morning. You couldn't decide whether to have Chinese or Italian food for dinner.
You can't solve
a problem.
Thank you for saying that too, because there seem to be some who have consumed, shall I say, the Kool-Aid on positivity and positive psychology.
Right,
as I said,
right.
I don't see problems. I only see opportunities.
Yeah. And that's bull. I mean, you know.
Thank you.
If you stay in the positive emotional attractor too long, you'll levitate. Now, the important issue is you need the negative emotional attractor, just like we need stress to function.
Yeah.
And again, to focus.
Correct.
So it's useful, but it's not good for you.
Yeah.
Because it compromises your immune system. It compromises you cognitively.
Sustained stress is damaging.
One of the neurological activations is the task positive network, which, by the way, is activated every time you raise something abstract or measurement oriented to people. So when you open a meeting with financial, I've been saying this since the 80s. Show me a leader who opens a meeting with financials, I'll show you an ineffective leader. And I've pissed off a whole bunch of Fortune 500 CEOs. But I still stand by it, because when you open a meeting with financials, you put everybody on defensive, even if the good news is good.
Yeah.
Because you're activating this other part of the brain.
So analytical thinking, that's part of the task positive network.
Exactly.
That's associated with a stress response. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's exactly right. That's the causal connection. While it's important to do, I mean, you have to solve problems. You have to make decisions. But appreciate when you're doing it, you're literally closing down. One set of psychologists in London did this study where they injected peripheral vision. I don't know if you know your peripheral vision. Most people who aren't pilots don't. But so you measure it by putting your hands about one length out from your shoulders. Start by staring at a dot right in front of you and move your hands out, staring at the dot right in front of you until you can't lose sight of them. Right there. It's mine right now. It's about 180 degrees. They gave a person a shot of epinephrine, adrenaline, in the nose.
It went down to 30 degrees.
Wow.
They waited a number of minutes, gave him a shot of oxytocin in the other nostril, which is parasympathetic, went back to 180.
Wow.
And you think about what happens strategically in organizations.
Yes.
You know, in strategy terms, this is called competition neglect.
Yeah.
You know, Kodak went bankrupt because they were worried about the color brilliance of Fuji's 35 millimeter film in the 90s when it was digital photography that was going to eat their lunch. And Kodak owned the original patents on digital cameras in 1974.
Yeah. Yeah. I've spoken to a couple of very successful, really top level, you know, the kind of people I don't usually have access to. But I've found just through informal conversation, a lot of them, yeah, they call it reflection, right? But essentially, it's your renewal state. They really block off substantial amounts of time in their calendar. You know, Friday afternoon. I know one guy who blocks off his entire Friday afternoon just for reflection.
Savvy, really savvy.
Because he knows he starts to do this, and it's a way for him, he says, to focus on the things that are important, not necessarily to be drawn into things that are urgent. And that maps so perfectly on this task positive network. And what's the opposite? Is that the default mode network?
The one I'm part of the positive emotional attraction is the default mode. By the way, that's what Warren Bennis found when he and Bert Nanus and a few others later studied leaders worldwide. They found that the ones who were better, that consistently had better performance in their organizations, had what he called reflective strategies, where they literally would either take time out each week or each month to just reflect. And I mean, he was, you know, one of the doyens of leadership research and also another mentor of mine, which I appreciated. But you're exactly right. It's very hard to make sense of things unless you can periodically go into this positive emotional attractor state. Yeah. Now, the key thing is, and we've now got published data showing that it is important to regularly re-enter this state during each day. And the key is not to spend an hour and a half meditating. The key is to spend 15 minutes, five or six times throughout the day, getting into this state. And while you can do it through meditation, yoga, deep breathing, physical exercise, prayer to a loving God, you also can do it interpersonally by helping someone in need.
Yeah.
Or the research has shown helping the elderly. I tell my graduate students, helping your elderly professors will get you closer to heaven. But it also is through humor. Through actually the one that I love the most recently is through playing music, not just listening, but actually playing or dancing gets you into this renewal state. So the key is, I think the leaders who invoke creative thought and innovation and excitement and engagement periodically invoke this mood in their meetings, in their discussions with their colleagues. And it's not like you do it all the time. It's not like you become a social worker, but it's this notion of doses. Yeah. So thinking about this back and forth, and what we're showing in these various physiological studies is that it's like a seesaw. So you need to move back and forth. And although we had a few, we had a grant over 100,000 to study this in the heads of the firefighting, wild forest firefighting teams worldwide in the U.S. Unfortunately, we were able to get one part of the study done, but the study where we needed them to fly into Cleveland to go through an fMRI, there were too many forest fires, so they couldn't take 2 days out to do it. But but I suspect that the most effective leaders have developed a facility. They don't necessarily know why, but they've developed a facility with going back and forth. And this reflective moment that you were talking about, Romer, is exactly a good example. Yeah. But there are others that are less invasive, if you will, like periodically saying something funny in a meeting. Or just posing when you're in the heat of wrestling with something. Why are we doing this? I mean, what's the purpose?
Yeah.
I remember president of one of the largest investment banks, I don't want to name which, because they didn't do well in the crisis of 08 to 11. But I remember they had a very sophisticated leadership program, 3 weeks with full-time coaching and all this stuff spread out over a year for their directors. And they would always have me come in and do a three-hour session to kick off the second residency. But he would introduce me. And he would start out by saying to 35 of these very senior folks in this leading investment bank, why do we do what we do? And somebody would say to make money. He said, no, why do we do what we do? And some people are wrestling around. And he finally says, freedom. And they look at him, he says, freedom of choice. We do what we do to help our clients, whether they're individuals, families, organizations, or sovereign wealth funds, to have freedom of choice by having more resources. We evaluate how well we're doing by whether or not we're making money for them. Nice. So let's not confuse the purpose and the measure.
Yeah. Very nice. So a quick follow-up question. You mentioned the seesaw. You know, you got to be able to shift between the negative and the positive emotional attractor or state, whatever the term. There is some, as I understand it, there is some data out there, you know, prospect theory, that we're way more sensitive to a loss and to bad news than we are to the good. And so the rule of thumb that comes out of that is, you know, you sort of compensate for that by almost over investing in the positive, not by neglecting the negative, but really, you know, that ratio of 3-1.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right.
So does that translate into? Okay.
Matter of fact, that's part of what we did in testing in some of these hormonal studies and the fMRI studies. We tested where the ratio was. And yes, negative emotions are stronger than positive. Not better, but stronger. Now, why? We'd be dead if they weren't.
That's right.
You know, it's functional. It's important to flourish, but if somebody's shooting at you, you better duck.
Yeah.
You know, you have to stay alive. So survival, you know, long-term ecological survival requires being defensive. But if you're always defensive, it's a sad life. So your point is, the ratio, because of the strength of the negative, you have to overcompensate. Now, the key is, for a while, people thought, well, do the positive feedback sandwich, positive feedback, negative feedback, positive feedback. That's ridiculous. Because everybody is just waiting for the negative feedback.
That's right. Let's do the feedback thing. It's called the shit sandwich, right?
That's right.
Excuse my language.
That's right. That's exactly right. Now, look, everybody, no matter how good they are, if they're going to get feedback in a performance review, they're sitting there with their fingers in their ears saying, yes, thank you. I really appreciated that feedback. So this is another one of the sacred. So just to be clear, what we're saying is, you want to base the effort, the driver of an effort, in the PEA. So while the vision helps, but you need to periodically use the positive as the state that helps you move ahead, not the negative. And the way to do that is to periodically make sure you're doing it for yourself, so you're sustainable, still excited. You know, it's not just work. But also you're doing it for your staff, your employees, your customers, your clients, the people around you.
Yeah. Can I highlight this point really quickly also for the listener? Yeah. You know, imagine that you have an organization that's in some sort of existential, you know, trouble. Let's say Kodak. Right. And, you know, at some point the realization hits in, we are in a real state of threat. We must innovate or else we have to close our doors. Now, that may be factually accurate, but you're expecting your people to be innovative from a state of threat, when they're going to be focused on, you know, their focus is going to be narrow. They're going to be focusing on, you know, meeting their own needs maybe, or meeting their most essential KPIs, and sort of you're sabotaging the process because you yourself as a leader are in that state of threat. So what would your the reality, though, is there, right? We have to act with a sense of urgency. So what advice would you give a leader in terms of how to how to navigate that situation.
Preparation. There's a lesson to be learned from the special operators. You know, because I've worked with SEAL teams and instructors of Delta Force. I've even interviewed SAS members. They train incessantly for unbelievable different contingencies. So they don't get a mission and then fly off. They usually spend weeks or months planning. The planning is thinking through unbelievable number of contingencies, you know, from your gun jams to, you know, 40 more insurgents hit you to there's an RPG coming at you. What that means is by the time they get into the field, they know they're going to encounter uncertainties and things that they haven't thought of. But they're already prepared for 95% of the things that are going to happen to them. And they are so well prepared with each other that they don't have to think about it consciously.
Yeah.
Okay. That means that they're calmer when all the crap is happening.
I mean, and not just them, but all of the whole group is calmer.
Because I mean, a number of my executive doctoral students are veterans of special ops. I mean, one that I'm working with right now at 14 tours as a special operator. Wow. And yeah, I mean, and you're talking about the stuff that makes anybody nuts in so many different ways. But the, excuse me, but being in the thick of it, nobody quite understands until you've been under fire how noisy it is, how you get assaulted from every imaginable thing going on, and your body's reaction is to go defensive, literally.
Yep.
And that's not what you need to do. So I, in chapter 6 of my book, I talk about the fact that the learning agenda that I have in the intentional change theory is, you know, might be goal setting, but the spirit of it is preparation.
Gotcha.
So what happens is, what we say is, what you want to do is think about how you're going to get closer to the vision. Not the goals, the vision.
Mm.
How are you going to get closer to the vision using your strengths?
Mm.
And that, and then you start to visualize it. So visualization works really well. Well, visualization is a form of preparation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, it will take many hours of deliberate practice when you're trying to have a new behavior or thought pattern or approach or whatever, or in teams or in organizations, new norms. It takes a long time.
Yeah.
Okay. But part of it is thinking through all these possibilities. It doesn't mean you'll actually have thought the right answer, but it means that you're prepared for a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah. And in a way, that's an indictment of people who end up in that state of panic because they haven't done their homework in terms
of
plan and preparation.
Right. Now, one implication I was talking about with the PA-NEAs, PA ends up being the driver of the change and the initiator. But as you would point out, Romer, you really need to manage the balance.
Yeah.
Because everything that's going to happen to you is going to, almost everything, is going to drag you back into the NEA. That's life.
Yeah.
So the question ends up, do you build a facility internally, but also with your colleagues to periodically bring them back? So you're moving this kind of emotional and neurological and hormonal seesaw.
Yeah.
The other implication of that, which we mentioned with the feedback sandwich, is that feedback. On the whole, my recommendation to people is if you have feedback for somebody around you, keep it to yourself because it's not going to help them change.
Thank you.
It's not going to help them change. And if you really see somebody messing up and you want to correct them, go ahead. But know that you're not going to be motivating them to change their behavior. You're going to be correcting them, which means you're either vomiting on them or you're getting revenge. But if you want to motivate change, you've got to approach it differently. Now, it doesn't mean you don't do corrective action. I mean, as a parent, you know, we just picked up a 8-week-old puppy the other day, and there are things that she has to be told not to do. And we know that with our children.
And I'm going to test something with you here. I'm assuming you can do corrective action from a positive emotional state, and you can do it from a negative emotional state out of irritation and frustration.
Yeah. What I'm saying is both may be important to do.
Okay.
But that to the extent you have the intent to help motivate somebody to change, you want to do it on the positive.
Yeah. Because that communicates even before you've opened your mouth, right?
An example, I don't want to say who because he's a kind of management guru, but one of my good friends was having some long-term health problems and going through stuff with his one of his many doctors, his internist at some point. And at that point, one of his kids was 11 and the other 8. And his internist said to him, well, why do you want to get on top of this stuff and change your lifestyle so that it'll be healthier? And he kind of thinks, he said, well, I'd like to live long enough to see my kids get married. And she looked at him and she smiled and said, too short term. How about live long enough to go skiing with your grandchildren?
Wow.
And he sat back and his eyes lit up. And I remember him telling me about it afterwards. It was like one of those, oh my God, moments. So every time he wanted to remind himself to exercise or to not eat something he shouldn't eat or whatever, getting that image flashing in his head was a positive purpose. Now, there are times in which you have to give somebody negative feedback, just like there are times in which you have to fire somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, there are times in which, sadly, people have to get divorced. I'm just saying, be careful that you don't misunderstand that. That's not motivating somebody else to change.
Yeah. Yeah. Very clear. And it's almost along the same lines as sort of leadership as exercising your authority, as opposed to leadership as motivating and inspiring, winning hearts and minds.
That's right.
Okay. There are a couple of things you mentioned in the materials you sent me beforehand that really caught my attention. And I would love for you also to talk me through your intentional change theory, even if at a high level, so the listener also kind of gets a better understanding of where this conversation is coming from. You say tipping points are a mind-body conspiracy.
Right. We're holistic beings. There is no such thing as having a thought versus an emotion because your brain doesn't work that way. And your brain and your hormones are operating at unconscious levels. So people may be aware of something going on in themselves in half a second. Maybe if you've meditated for 30 years, you might be able to do it in 250,000ths of a second. Your brain's firing things off in 8 to 40 thousandths of a second. So I think the positive movement over the past 25, 30 years toward more emotional intelligence, more emotional awareness, more mindfulness has been the realization that you really need to figure out what's going on inside. We now know, and we've known this since about the year 2000, that because we're stimulating these neurological vibes, if you will, in each other, or all of us who are not on the spectrum. People on the spectrum have a dysfunction in the default mode network. But for everybody else, you're infecting people all the time. So the question is, do you know how you're infecting them? And that's where the more mindfulness or emotional awareness or emotional intelligence, the more you're on top of it. That's a part of this understanding the whole mind, body, spirit, if you will. We're holistic beings. The thing that's fascinating is the same thing can be said in any team. I mean, most people will appreciate this in their dyadic relationships, like if they have a spouse or a partner, and they've had been in that relationship for at least 7 years, they'll appreciate the fact that the relationship goes through these kind of mood swings. And that happens in organizations, and that happens in countries, in communities. So part of this issue is to say, how do we stay in touch with that? Now, intentional change theory is a theory of sustained desired change. I have 10 principles in it that are pretty well established, and I've published a lot of papers on it leading up to the synthesis in my recent book, which is not just the integration of 58 years of my work, but I've included the work from just under 2,000 other scholars, you know, in the references. So it's heady around that. But what it says is that the process of sustained desire change is, on the whole, nonlinear and discontinuous. So you have to watch out. You have to be patient. You have to watch for the fits and starts. And then when you look at the actual process of change, the key starting point is, do you have a sense of purpose, what I call an ideal self?
Maybe if you don't mind me jumping in, maybe we can take kind of a little hypothetical, but not so hypothetical case. We have a manager who's leading a department, a crew of, let's say, 10 people. And the complaint, if you will, is there is not enough accountability. People are just not and I hear this all the time in all these different contexts. People are not stepping up, taking responsibility. So the default approach is, we're going to create this this new core value that we call accountability, and we're going to hold each other accountable for being accountable. Which, you know, if you look at this through the lens of positive and negative emotionally attractor, basically conjures up more of a stress response, which is probably going to have the opposite effect of what's desired. So if we take your intentional change theory as a framework for sort of advising this manager, what would be the first thing she would need to do?
I would say, talk to your folks about why you're doing what you're doing as a team.
Okay.
Focus on the purpose.
That's the purpose.
Focus on the purpose.
Yeah, purpose on the purpose.
Because why the vision, are we here? As I say to people, you know, even executives I'm coaching, yes, your presenting problem is important. But first, help me with the big picture of you. Let me get the strategic picture. And that's what she should be focusing on. Now, the way to do it is not to try to spend an hour talking about it, because that makes everybody feel like they're wasting time. The idea, again, is dosage. So have a series of 10, at most 15-minute conversations every time the group, the team gets together. Kick it off with talking about purpose. When you talk about the ideal self, or what you're trying to do is get to a shared vision, you are going to talk about, what are the core values? Who are we, if you will? What's our brand? What's our distinctiveness?
Is that the real self you're talking about now?
No. This is the ideal self. This is part of the ideal self.
Sorry, but it is the second phase.
It's still on the ideal self, the vision.
Yep. Okay.
Talking about your sense of calling. And then, you know, you're talking about what lifts you up and helps you to feel hopeful.
Yeah.
At some point, and telling stories about clients that were helped, or innovations that were discovered, really gets everybody to say, yes, that's what it's about. I believe if you do that, one of the values that will come about is respecting each other.
Mm.
And at the heart of any innovation process is diversity of thought. Well, you don't have diversity of thought because you have people of different races, colors, genders, faiths sitting around a table. You have diversity of thought when people sitting around a table talk to each other and listen to each other.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You have to have some values and norms about how you deal with each other.
Yeah.
It is impossible to express that and not appreciate the fact that part of it is everybody should be doing what they say they're going to do.
Yeah.
Accountability. Yeah. So instead of coming down with the hammer, let's measure accountability.
Yeah.
You're talking about, let's measure the aspiration. So you go from the ideal self or the shared vision to the real self because you are spending a little bit of time in this positive emotional attractor. So you're open.
Yep.
Now you want to ask the question, how are we doing? Hmm. I mean, as a team, are our norms close to our ideal?
Hmm.
And in looking at that, the group identifies some norms that are working really well, i.e. strengths, and some that aren't. Then, again, if you inject the purpose, go back to the purpose and the quality of the relationships, mm-hmm. you then open up to the third discovery in ICT, which is a learning agenda. What might we try to get closer to our vision using our strengths? Maybe work on one weakness, but no, I'm not focusing on that. I'm focusing on getting to the vision using our strengths. Once you establish an agenda, which is not a performance improvement plan, it's quite
exactly.
the opposite.
That's also worth highlighting. This is about learning and not a to-do list. Yes.
Then again, if you have a moment of PEA, you can move into the fourth discovery, which is where you're doing the deliberate experimentation and practice with the new thoughts, feelings, behaviors, etc. And all of that is in the context of these more resonant relationships, which are relationships that have a higher degree. We've got over now 55 empirical studies showing this in leadership and organizations. The higher the degree of shared vision, the more engagement, the more performance, the more resilience, the more satisfaction, the more innovation, the more organizational citizenship, the higher the shared compassion of caring for each other, the higher the shared energy. So we know that there are certain qualities of relationships that really matter. And that those are the five key discoveries of intentional change theory. And the tipping points, the PEA versus NEA, help you move along that. The last three principles in intentional change theory is that it's a multi-level system. So you can't help a team change without getting the dyads and the individuals to change and not getting the organization to change. Because yeah. they're all going to be feeding off of one another positively or negatively.
yeah.
And that then I get specific about the thing that moves emotion and information across the levels are the most positively, effectively, are resonant leadership relationships and social identity groups. And we don't have time to go into all that, but okay. that's talking about the cross-level stuff.
Yeah. Can you briefly, though, describe what you mean by resonant
sure.
leadership relationships?
Goes back to this notion of leadership as a relationship. And what we've okay. done is measured that the more effective leadership is occurring when there is a higher degree of shared vision, purpose, mm-hmm. shared yep. compassion, caring, compassion. And shared energy.
Got it.
We're on the same wavelength. We're on the same vibe.
That's fantastic. And, you know, it's I can only imagine how difficult it is to basically distill what's essentially seems like a lifetime's worth of work into a couple of bullet points that are easily accessible. So I hope I didn't stretch you too much with this line of questioning.
No, you were superb, and you put your finger exactly on some of the most powerful implications of the research.
Great. For the listener, I want to remind you that the book is called The Science of Change, Discovering Sustained Desired Change from Individuals to Organizations and Communities. You will find a lot to chew on there. So that could be a great place to continue your learning journey. Richard, thank you so very much for this wonderfully engaging and fruitful conversation. I really
appreciate
your
time. Thank you, Omar.
Okay. Take care.